Judy, right from go this morning, what you were doing had a kind of, I'm going to use the word tone to it, a feeling about it that, oh, these things are hard to articulate because they're such multi-layered intersections, but it had a feeling of welcome about it. And you know, I mean, even with people that are absolute pros at presenting, professional performers, speakers, whatever, you know, people whose presentation is something they do every day and it's polished and rehearsed, even in settings like that, sometimes, you know, you feel like you hear someone sing a song and you feel like they're sort of just radiating welcome to you to join in whatever it is that the song is about, to enter the place the song came from and comes from. And I can remember a folk fest performance, an evening a few years ago now, where in the same evening, I think, one of the performers was an artist named Passenger and another was an artist named Cheryl Crow. In general terms, we're probably more likely to have heard of the second artist than the first. But the first artist burned the place down somehow, because everything about them said, you come on in here with me, you know, I want to be here with you. And the other artist said, you know, I've got this. If you see me tomorrow night in, you know, at the festival in Thunder Bay, you'll get the same show. I'll be the same kind of present there that I was here, and it won't really invite you in. And I'm not being critical of the artists. Artists are humans too. They have lives. Another night it might have been different. But when it happens, you know, when someone makes something that draws us in, and we'll sort of be exploring this a little bit more later as well. When someone makes something that draws us in, the sense of welcome, it is profound. And I feel like you did that work. The work that has to be done for that to happen for a whole bunch of people this morning, Judy. And I'm really grateful you sort of nailed my space anyway, in lots of ways this morning. Not least of all with your song, Breathe Deep, which is a song that I've always appreciated and continue to appreciate. And yes, we will breathe together in another way as well. And I'm so grateful that we get to do both. I want to acknowledge that I am also grateful to be able to live and work and share community and meaningful life on this part of the planet, which history of includes, among other things, being Treaty 1 land and the homeland of the Métis Nation. Again, things we'll touch on in other ways as we go. But for now, I'm grateful for the welcome. Let's take a few moments to breathe together. I don't know if you've had occasion to be outside yet this morning. Odds are maybe fair that you haven't, unless you have a pet that needs a morning, you know, constitutional or something. What a funny word for they need to pee. Anyhow, but between the sun and the wind this morning, you know, it's sunny and it smells like rain. You know, that feeling of spring. And I don't know about you, but it's been a while. Maybe I can't even recall a spring or a late winter where those smells and feels felt like they mattered so much. So it's a beautiful day. And I hope that if you haven't been able to get out and enjoy any of it, that at some point today you will get to. Well, let's take a few moments to breathe together in another practice. Other than the one Judy's already offered us, which is to breathe together as we sing, which, can I just take a moment to say that one of the reasons that music is so important in things that are mysterious, one of the reasons it moves us, is because it offers us, it even compels us, especially if we're singing aloud, to breathe together. I don't know if you've thought about that. Maybe you have. But if you're a musician who studies this, you quickly learn that there are these lengths of time in music called phrases, the beginning of which is a breath and at the end of which is a breath. And if you're singing the song or playing the song together with others in a way that requires breath to make sound, breathing together becomes a very important part of making harmonious and synchronous music together, to being joined in music making. So, all to say, I think that's a very profound way to breathe together. Not a lesser way to breathe together than the way we're about to do. If you are just popping in, or if you're listening to the podcast of this, just a note for our podcast listeners, I will shorten the breathing time on the podcast as always, but just pause it and breathe as long as you want and then, you know, return. But if you're part of the live stream this morning, then let me just reiterate that this is an invitation to participate in something. And again, Judy's already set the tone for this by talking about connecting with divine or God or earth or love. And I don't remember all the descriptors you use, Judy, but this generous offering of saying, maybe this will connect for you. And if it does, I hope you feel free to just lean into it. And if it doesn't, I hope you feel free to just move to the side and let it go by and still feel like you're here with a group of people and profoundly welcome. All right. So as our practice, for those who are joining in this morning, let's do what we've been doing. I've been continuing to sort of experiment with this in my own practice. And I have found that longer cradling of the breath, for me at least, feels like it sort of expands my attentiveness to breath, my mindfulness to breath and life. And so for purely personal reasons, I have a preference there. If you have input about other breathing practices or other things you might be you think might be beneficial to us as a community in this space, I'd love to hear about them. And you can contact me through Facebook or by email, or my phone number, I think, is on the website as well. And so you can always send me a text or leave me a message. I would welcome those ideas. So for now, in for a count of four through your nose. And there's a brain reason for that. When we breathe in through our noses, it sends signals to our brain about what's happening in our body. And it kind of opens us to the good things that come from mindfulness and breathing mindfully. So in through your nose for a count of four, and then just cradle your breath. So don't choke it off. Just hold it inside your body and let your body feel full with it for a count of seven, and then out for a count of eight, and empty right out. And we'll do that four times. Okay, all good? Let's breathe together. Peace, everybody. Well, I have been thinking a lot lately about what really matters and why I value what I value. And there are several reasons for that, but in no small part, I think that line of reflection has been prompted for me by the way that the COVID pandemic has upset so many assumptions in my own life, perhaps in your life, certainly globally. And I feel as though those circumstances have prompted a much more widespread conversation about what is worth focusing our lives on and what sorts of things have been revealed as sort of, you know, not what they seem or not what they appear to be. And that feels especially pertinent when it comes to assessing the permanence of things. Now, that sentence can be readily understood in a few different ways. The word things, I think, is the key, the permanence of things. How am I using the word things? Am I meaning to use the word things in that sentence in the broadest, least specific sense? I once had a public speaking instructor abrade an entire class about the ineffectiveness of using the words things or stuff in an outline, as in, I want to talk to you today about three things, or I want to talk to you today about some stuff. He said those were not meaningful terms. They didn't help us focus on anything in particular, and they certainly wouldn't move anyone toward a new understanding or a meaningful action, which from their perspective at least was, you know, the reason you would talk to someone, to a group of someone's. So That made so much sense to me at that point in my life that I have since made the same point to people I've taught about public speaking in different settings over the years. And I've made that point in ways that I now wish I had added a bit more nuance to, which I suppose, I suppose I could say that about just about anything I've taught anyone ever. And expect that feeling will probably just grow as you know, hopefully as perspectives widen over time. But on that, certainly. Now, this is probably not a surprise, but if you look up the word thing, you will not find one definition, you will find several. Merriam-Webster's online dictionary offers no less than 10 distinct definitions for the word thing, including this beauty: the proper or fashionable way of behaving, talking, or dressing, used with the, as in, that's the thing these days. I don't know, sometimes if you read the dictionary with a little more inflection, it's more interesting. Anyway, I like that one. But it's the first two definitions in that particular list that I want to use as a springboard for our exploration this morning. So those definitions are, so definitions one and two are: an object or entity not precisely designated or capable of being designated. Use this thing. If you grew up in my family, thing used that way tended to turn into thingamabob, you know? Yeah, get the yellow thingamabob from under the sink and that should work, you know, kind of like that. Object or entity not precisely designated or capable of being designated. The second definition in the list is an inanimate object distinguished from a living being. An inanimate object distinguished from a living being. Now, of these two definitions, I want to auger in a little more on the second one. An inanimate object distinguished from a living being, sort of as in, you know, the garage is full of things and stuff. We know that all sorts of problems arise when we treat people, when we treat humans as things and stuff. We've just spent the last 6 weeks or so exploring some ideas around decolonizing our thinking in general and our thinking about colonial enactments of religion in particular. And at the heart of many of those explorations, we found the expression of notions, and in the case of the history of the Christian church, the expression of doctrines or dogma that reduced humans to things, and that even measured the relative humanity of people based on other ideas, such as the notion of race. I don't recall that I was ever specific about this in those talky bits, but by way of illustration, it's a matter of public record that in the original version of the American Constitution, black persons were officially designated as 3/5 human. Did you catch that? In the original version of the American Constitution, black persons were officially designated as 3/5 human. I haven't done enough homework on that in specific to know how that calculation was made. And unless I think it might help move a conversation about undoing such a process, I probably won't invest the time in more specific investigation. Not because it's not important. I think it's very important. Personally, I mean, I think if we don't learn from history, we're much more likely to repeat it. So that's one reason why it would matter. But at this point, at least, I'm not inclined to focus on what kind of calculation would produce that kind of an outcome, because I think the outcome itself is categorically nonsense. You can't even do that kind of air quotes math without first turning people into things. How do you measure fifths of humanity, of being human? And I am not interested in doing that. I'm not interested in turning people into things. And I believe that to do so is both harmful and absurd. And yet, it's the same kind of thinking that was and is running in the background of genocidal actions of the government of the Dominion of Canada when such government would take strategic steps to make Indigenous persons more, air quotes again, fully human, to, quote, civilize them by eradicating their indigeneity, a rather central aspect of their humanness. So while it might appear ridiculous when we name it out loud, It's also something that is both common and systemically ongoing. Why would we be inclined, do you think, as a species, to regard others of our kind, our kin, as things rather than as persons? Maybe one of the obvious reasons is that to do so makes it easier for us to think strategically rather than personally about destroying one another. Huh. That sounds a little grim, doesn't it? So let me unpack it a little bit. If thinking about people as things rather than as persons makes it easier for us to think strategically about doing harm, whether that's through undeniably violent mechanisms such as war, or less apparently violent actions such as the marketing of things that are destructive, whether those things are values or products, then it eases something that I think sometimes we feel like is inevitable, which is that harm will be done in the process of making society. Let's bring it a little closer to home. Maybe that still feels too 30,000 foot-ish. If we think about that question, why would we do such a thing? Why would we regard other people as things rather than as people? I think one of the reasons we might do such an action or take such a position is because it's much easier to hold on to our cherished prejudices if we think of those not like us in ways that objectify them. And not just our prejudices, but habits we have, ways of being, interacting, consuming, all these kind of things. But can we hear that? Can we hear that objectify them for what it really says? To objectify someone is to turn them into an object, like things and stuff. Well, for me, at least, there's a linkage to all of that and this question that I opened with, which is a question about assessing the value of or permanence of what we value. And one of the linkages between those two bits is that if we can so readily succumb to ideas that turn people into things, why would we be surprised if we're vulnerable to treating things as though they were as valuable or even more valuable than people? We might sort of pull back from a sentence like that and we would think, I would never do that. I would never treat a thing as though it was more valuable than a person. Are we sure? This can be pretty subtle sometimes, but there are ways to test ourselves to see if we're in danger of doing something that we might, if we're talking about it, strenuously disavow. For the record, this might not help you much if what I've already said got your back up somehow, but for my part, I believe we all do this. We are surrounded by it constantly in the forms of marketing, strategic thinking, the cost of doing business, kinds of logic, our own internal justifications of things that we do that we know are not good and that might harm others or objectify others, and so on. When I'm talking about this stuff or thinking about this stuff in the context of community, this is not about blaming or shaming. At least that's not why I'm doing it. I can't control how it lands, but that's not what the sender is on about. The reason I want to explore this stuff is because I find that this is how I learn and grow. And my life in community over time has suggested that this is how we learn and grow. This is about upping our attenuation to something we might not otherwise notice, becoming more sensitized to it, more aware of it. And becoming more sensitized to and aware of something that we might otherwise turn away from or not notice unless or until it's pretty egregious, until it's pretty, like, you know, violent in the street. Now, because this can be pretty subtle, and because we all have ways of hiding these sorts of things from ourselves and ignoring them when they're all around us, I find it helpful to have some litmus tests. And one of the simplest ways that I know of to test myself on this is to ask what I would be most stressed about losing. So this is a way to test what I value. It's wisdom of long standing that what I treasure, I fight to preserve, right? And I realize whenever we take these big complex things and we squish them down into a sentence like that, we necessarily leave out a bunch of nuance. So I want to unpack that a little bit. Obviously, we won't exhaust it, but maybe it'll give us some avenues to go down that that allow us to both raise our attenuation and not sort of collapse back into either or thinking. The religious tradition that I grew up in was the Christian tradition. And in the Christian tradition, of course, the primary voice is the teachings of Jesus. And so those are often my reference points, even though what I believe about those stories and how I look at them and how I understand them and how I plug them in has changed a great deal over time. And in fact, in some ways, I think probably some of my early teachers would not recognize my current perspective as what they think of as Christian. That's still the tradition that I know the best. And those are the words often, those are the teachings that are kind of ringing in my ears and in my psyche when I look at these big questions and try to wrestle with them. And so often the way that I think about those teachings now is as part of the genius of this first century rabbi, this Jewish rabbi Jesus, the genius of Jesus. There's brilliance in these teachings. And whether you look at them as a, you know, again, quotes, believer or from some other perspective. And in the genius of Jesus, this idea that what I treasure, I fight to preserve, shows up in a bunch of places, but it shows up most clearly in his sort of greatest hits collection in the books of Matthew and Luke. And it's easy to miss the wider point of these sayings because the translations could be misleading, and I think because they've often been, these texts have often been, how do I even say this? I was going to say conveniently mistaught, which suggests that what I'm about to do is not that. And of course, my perspective would be more that our understandings are evolving all the way along. But I think there have been ways in which these have been sort of blatantly misapplied fairly often, to the point where we tend to, if we're familiar with them, we kind of get this quick pass at them and we're like, yeah, I know what that one says. I know what it means. I've been told that a million times. And maybe what we've been told is, in fact, not a very good treatment of what we know about the context for the words and the words themselves and the teacher. Anyway, we're going to unpack that a bit. So probably one of the best known sort of litmus test sayings in these collections on this matter of what do I value and why is found in Matthew, also in Luke, but in Matthew 6:21, where Jesus famously advises his listeners to, quote, store up treasures in heaven rather than on earth, because on earth, the odds are pretty good that whatever you store up is going to rust, rot, break, burn down, or get stolen. It's sort of a grim list for stuff. Now, we're only going to hit on the high points of this today, but where this saying often goes sideways, in religion land at least, is when someone tries to use it with or as an equivalence of heaven being aligned with adherence to some particular religious belief or religious activity, or kind of investing in those beliefs or activities. Sort of as in, don't invest materially in your house, make a donation to God's house, because that's what's going to last forever. Now, that doesn't work on a whole bunch of levels. The obvious one is that infrastructure is vulnerable to all the things Jesus mentioned, burn down, break, rust, you know, whatever. And so are organizations, so the social things we make around ideas, and so are the people that comprise them. And just ask anyone who's had to let staff go or close buildings in this past year because donations were down. Now, to be clear, because it could sound like I'm veering off into some sort of strange, you know, financial pitch or something, which I'm not. To be clear, I believe that it is a lovely idea to support your community, religious or otherwise. If we don't support our communities, they don't either thrive or, you know, maybe they cease to exist in that form. Here's the thing, though. Let's just not think that this supporting of our community is what Jesus is on about here, or that supporting something religious is a way of buying some particular experience in the afterlife. Speaking of which, The other way that this saying often goes sideways is when people think that Jesus was talking about some other place than here, as in earth, when he used the word that we tend to translate into in English versions of this saying as the word heaven. Similarly, the case for hell, but that's for another day. It's a bit of a study, but here's the short version. Until about 200 years before Jesus' time, Jewish thought, and remember, Jesus is not a blue-eyed, blonde-haired, you know, airbrushed person of European descent, historically speaking. This is a first century Jewish rabbi we're talking about here. Until about 200 years before Jesus' time, Jewish thought didn't include any concept of the soul as distinct from the rest of the person. It did not include any concept of the soul as existing separately from the body. Soul, at that period of Jewish thought, was synonymous with breath. And so that's why if you're reading in the Hebrew sacred texts, what many Christian collections would call the Old Testament, that's why if you're reading in those texts, death is so sad and so tragic, so mournful. It's because to the mind that is generating those texts, there is nothing after it. Full stop. There is no eternal anything in that view of the human person. There's nothing good, there's nothing bad, there's nothing. When you stop breathing, you stop being. So that's about 200 years before Jesus is around. And then, right about that point, as far as you know, we can tell from the documents we have, things start to evolve a little bit. And so about the time Jesus was teaching, there had begun to be this idea that beyond death, there might be some sort of justice to come, some sort of future just world. And I think that's pretty understandable that that idea would emerge when it did, given the ongoing oppression that this people group was under as they were, you know, oppressed by the Roman Empire. That idea, that there might be some sort of justice to come, some sort of just society waiting in the wings, that's the idea that Jesus was referencing when he talked about what our English translations call and put the words in his mouth as when he talked about the kingdom of God. The idea was that the kingdom of God was something that would happen right here on earth. So that's what was going on in Jewish thought at the time when Jesus is talking about these things. But there is no concept in Jewish thought at that point in history of an afterlife. There is no heaven or hell, as many of us have been taught about them. There's no concept of these places as actual places where the essence of someone actually goes. So that's not what Jesus is working with. Those ideas are not there. Now, Jesus meshed with, you know, all kinds of cherished ideas, and he did have his own twist on all this. And this is the twist that we might be more familiar with from his teachings, because that idea that there might be a just society to come in a religious setting gave religious leaders a fairly obvious and incredibly powerful lever to use regarding people's behavior, adherence, commitment, giving, and so on and so forth, right? All these kind of functional things about religion. And that lever was the idea that the way you got to be part of this just utopia was by making sure you believed and did the right things. And that's what Jesus blows up over and over again. He just says, nope, not a bad idea as far as it takes you, but basically it's going to take you as far as realizing you can't pull it off. I don't know if you've ever watched The Good Place, but this is one of the ideas that smash comedy hit has at over and over and over again, that the tally system actually will never get you to the good place. It's very interesting the way that it gets dealt with comedically. But that's the same category of thinking. And Jesus just says no in his teachings. He says, nope. Whatever it looks like to make a good world in the just moral sense, to make a place where things are right, we don't get there by keeping the rules or by having and demonstrating adherence to some particular set of right beliefs. Jesus taught that the path to that just world, what she also famously called narrow, was loving the divine above all else, even when you're suffering, and working diligently for the welfare of others, even when that's a really hard thing to do. The bumper sticker, love God, an idea that Jesus defined very crisply as love. So love, love, uppercase, and love others. That, Jesus taught, is the way to bring about what we could, I think, fairly call, from the perspective of this first century Jewish rabbi, heaven on earth. Now, this is an interesting thing. Even in an era when people are walking away from traditional religion in droves, statistics still say that the majority of North Americans believe in some kind of literal heaven and hell. More in heaven than in hell by about 20%, which, you know, seems curiously selective when you stand back from it a little bit. I kind of like the idea of everything being lovely forever, but the idea of everything being awful forever, that one's easy to let go of, right? So clearly some selective preferences here. In any case, whatever the percentages are, those concepts that people are saying they believe in or don't believe in the questionnaire, those concepts are ones that can clearly be traced back to Virgil, to Plato, to the Middle Ages in general, and in terms of imagery, to Dante in particular, especially as regards the imagery of hell. But they can't really be traced back to Jesus. So, in the context of the table, which is an interesting community about in lots of ways, but not least of all as regards the many different perspectives people might have on the teachings of Jesus, in the context of the table, where one of the challenges can often be that when we go exploring, we find our own beliefs stretched to the limits by the beliefs of others, I would say we are free to believe what we want about all of this, of course, but we may wish to be careful what we attribute to a first century Jewish rabbi when we should be attributing it to a medieval writer of epic poetry, let's say, in the case of Dante. Now, with all of that in mind, here's a bit of a thought-for-thought paraphrase of that Jesus saying about where to store up treasure, which brings us back to our consideration of what we place value in. So here's the thought-for-thought paraphrase of that Matthew text. It's obvious, isn't it? The place where your treasure is the place where you will most want to be and end up being. It's obvious, isn't it? The place where your treasure is the place you will most want to be and end up being. Which, in my creative process, brings us to the video that I posted and to the idea of ephemerality. I hope you had a chance to watch that clip. I know some of you did because there were some comments. I started promptly getting a couple of emails from people who were, you know, responding to that or reacting to that clip. If you're listening to the podcast version of this and you haven't seen any of the imprint advance information about this morning, the clip that I'm talking about is the trailer for the documentary about longtime Quebecois kids TV show host Claude Lafortune. The English title of that documentary is The Paper Man. So just, I'm giving you all that information partly because if you go look it up on your own and you just go into YouTube and type in The Paper Man, you'll get a different movie. You have to kind of go a little deeper to find the documentary. Now, and by the way, if you're on the Facebook page and you're like, where's the clip? Just scroll that down a little bit. I checked, you know, just in between Judy and I and it's there. Lafortune died this past April. He was in his 80s. I believe, but he died from COVID, which he contracted when he was admitted to the hospital for other health concerns. I think something that still kind of has a little bit of a sense of irony for some of us. Anyway, his work, if you've seen the documentary or looked any of it up elsewhere online, his work is stunning. I wasn't familiar, so partly the impact might just be that it's fresh to me, but not just that, it's remarkable. It's really remarkable. And not least of all, because the materials that he used were so ordinary. I mean, you watch him work, and it's a piece of paper and a pair of scissors. And it's like just him and the scissors and this picture that he has in his head that he's trying to bring to be in the world. La Fortune did not regard himself as an artist. That comes through in a limited way in the trailer. He had endured mockery earlier in his career from the arts community, who regarded what he was doing as crafts. Anyway, not going to chase that one. But he was also known to say that he didn't believe what he was making was art because it wouldn't last. Because it was, wait for it, ephemeral. Ephemerality is the concept of things being transitory, of things existing only briefly. And since we all tend to think about and interact differently with an idea like time, this is obviously a fairly pliable concept. But at the heart of it, there is this idea that things are fleeting. And much of what La Fortune made on his TV show, and there's a couple of clips where he just has these, like, just entire sort of crowds of objects of art that he has made. Much of what he made on his TV show was simply destroyed. It was paper, right? Which is a very painful idea when I see his work. Here's the thing, at least for me. And this is an idea that got sort of exponentially more painful for me when I watched him interact with kids on the show in those clips from his past as a TV show host. What he is doing over and over again on that show is celebrating all kinds of kids from all sorts of backgrounds with all kinds of sometimes complicated conditions and stories. And it goes by pretty fast in the trailer. I didn't even catch it the first time. But there's this moment where La Fortune, as a now elderly man, is at some kind of public function. He meets a woman at this party. He calls her by name, and he gives her this. There's this warm hug. There's this warm greeting between them. And then we see a clip of him back in the era of the show, decades earlier, interacting with her on the set when she was just a kid. And you realize the thing that La Fortune was most deeply invested in, and quite possibly the reason he had trouble seeing his own paper creations as art, was because as much as those creations authentically came out of a place of his own unique creativity and vision, and as much as they took up hours and years of his life, they were, I think, demonstrably not the place where his treasure was. And somehow this idea that art objects should be treasures of a different magnitude is at play here. That place, the place of treasure for La Fortune, was clearly held by people, was held by relationships, it was held by person-to-person interactions across a wide range of diversity of persons and interactions. All of those things and stuff, what we make, the ancient Hebrew sages would say, are ephemeral. And they may be heart-stoppingly beautiful, the way that the flowers that bloom just, you know, overnight and are gone, you know, the next afternoon in the desert, or the grasses of the field that get burned up, you know, in these texts. That's ephemerality. That's here today and gone tomorrow, as we are, really. And yet, in the interview that I heard with the documentary filmmaker, she talked about not realizing how profound this human-to-human connection was until she was traveling around to events with La Fortune, and time after time, people younger than him would come up to him, ask if they could give him a hug or shake his hand, and then they would tell him some story about the huge impact that he made on their lives as children because of his show. Decades later. You don't react that way to someone just because you like what they make. You react that way to someone because you have some inkling of who they are. Because you find yourself able to believe that if they knew you, and maybe even if they didn't, they would value you. And sometimes, in ways that are quite mysterious, that can also come through in what we make, in the things and stuff. Maybe we're closest to what Jesus seemed to mean by heaven when we are with others who do the hard work, at least the sometimes hard work, of not regarding people as things and stuff. Maybe when we do that or attempt to do that work ourselves, what we're placing value in may seem ephemeral, fragile, vulnerable, prone to being here one moment and being gone the next. And it's tempting to maybe devalue that, to say, that's not important because it won't last. But in a curious twist, that seems to be pretty much what Jesus would say would reach toward whatever mystery comes after ephemerality. That's what defines the place where our treasure is the place we will most want to be and end up being. Now, all being well, that won't be a place full of things and stuff, but filled with people and love and the things that love has made. Peace.